Fan.
The Phantom Wicks and Jewelers want to give you a shot to put a grand in your hand. Sorry, we're a little bit late, but it's our national cash contest, and the keyword for the 4 o'clock hour is cash. Text the keyword cash to 200-200.
Well, I had a hunch that today might be a difficult day to maintain clock management. We'll do the best we can to get caught up, because we still have Lou Nanny after a short pause here. We've got Bob Hagan, Vikings Media Relations, at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. We have Bud Grant, part two, and we also have in the five, and we also have Patrick Royce is scheduled to join us at about 5:30 this very evening. I have, like I said, I've got several more Sid stories. The tape recorder story I'll save, but I'm running out of time. When am I going to get the tape recorder story? Do I do it right now, or is it going to put us too far behind?
We can do it. You can get it in now.
Well, let me do it now.
Why don't you do it with Louie?
I could do it with Louie. That's true. Maybe that's the way around.
Yeah.
But that might be the answer, because it's 100% true. I think I've told it before, but it's been quite a while. And in my mind's eye, I can still see it. And it's still, you know, a lot of this stuff is very emotional for people. But the objective today, too, was also to try to put a smile on your face on some of the absurd stories that and battles we all had with Chad. In this case, with Sid, I should say. In this case, it wasn't a battle so much as just an unusual occurrence after a Vikings game that was played at the Metrodome. And after Sid and I both went into the Star Tribune building at 425 Portland Avenue, which doesn't exist anymore. You get the pattern? My goodness, it just means we're all apparently getting old. Lou Nanny gets younger by the year, though. He just might have a Sid yarn or two to spin.
Fan.
It's just like when a coach gets fired. Everybody says, oh, the guys, the players love the coach. And maybe they did. And they say they feel bad that day and they feel sorry for the coach. And next day, hey, where are you going for
practice? Well, you got your practice. Yeah. How about your hockey guys?
That's what I'm saying. The same thing.
There were no bargains.
Hockey guys?
Some of your hockey guys I knew pretty well. They did pretty good.
How do we get on to these guys?
Should I tell you the difference?
No, don't.
Should I tell you the difference?
They were good guys.
Don't tell me I knew about them.
There's no difference.
Let me just tell you, buddy.
What's this guy to the left?
If you let me say a word,
okay, we're ready.
Go
ahead, Sid. Go ahead.
You're worse than Bart Starr.
Ah, the sports show, Louie. You, Sid, Royce, oh my goodness. Those are the days, eh?
They really were. We had so much fun. By the way, what a great conversation with Chad. You were just fabulous.
He was terrific. I really appreciate his willingness to not just come on, but to open up to the degree that he did. I'd heard some stuff I had not heard before. So, you know, I don't know if you have any insight into this, because, you know, we played part one of our interview with Bud. And Bud says, look, he's been my best friend for 75 years. And, you know, even though he says we really didn't have all that much in common, he didn't, you know, there are a lot of things they didn't agree on. One guy was athletic. One guy wasn't exactly that. One guy liked to hunt. The other guy didn't like to. But from afar, I almost feel like there are a lot of people who got close to Sid who weren't necessarily, who were different in many, many ways. I don't know if you'd put yourself in that same category, but what is it that still had him develop, at least in some cases, these relationships, do you think?
Well, I think there was the trust that he built up right away with people. It was just amazing how close he could get to people so quickly. And people felt comfortable with him, and he certainly felt comfortable with everybody. If he didn't, he'd let you know about it. You know, he couldn't hold back on anything. Whatever he was going to feel, he was going to say. So that was just his personality. So many people got close to Sid because they enjoyed being around him, but they trusted him. And he had a unique personality because, as you said, the guy wasn't gifted athletically, but people from the athletic world loved to be with him. The guy, he was fun. Part of it was maybe his demeanor, and part of it was the fact that he could take a joke or picking on you because you knew he was going to pick on you back. So, I mean, there was a lot of give and take. And it was so funny, you know, time and time again, like you were just playing on a sports show. I just wish that people could see what happened when we were off camera because it was just unbelievable. And after that, and he was like me, he likes pie. And after the show, whenever I'd be in a show with him, we have to go for pie. He and I and Maxie would always go for a piece of pie. Royce would come occasionally. But and just to see him interact even with the waitresses, the people, yeah. You know, sitting in booths or, you know, we might get a little loud. It was a unique thing because he was a unique person.
You know, Chad talked a lot about his level of competitiveness, which I know very well. You know very, very well as well. And as an example of that, it would show up on everything, including like, okay, if he has a book out and you have a book out, he wants to believe there's no chance that you could sell more books than he could sell. It never, I mean, that was him. That was a part of him, and it didn't matter what the subject was. He was going to continue to push and to basically attempt to leave you with the idea of you never got the better of him, correct?
Well, I got to tell you, Pat Royce, he edited my book with Bob Showers, mm-hmm. and he also, as you know, did Sid's book. And so when we had the opening, when I was taking History and Memory of the North Stars out, we had it downtown at Barnes & Noble, and Sid said, I can't remember who he said it to, he said, I don't think many people go to that, what do you think? And he said, I think they're going to be. And we had a humongous crowd, 4 hours.
We were there. We did a show. One of the times we did a show from
That's
there
right,
with you. Yeah.
Well, the best was, so we sold a lot of books. And while we're selling the books, I looked up, and Sid's book that he had brought out a year ago was upstairs in the second floor of Barnes & Noble. And here he comes with an armful of books. He must have had 10 books. And brought them right down to the counter and put them right beside the cash register where my book was. And I said, to Showers, I said, take a look at that. He just will not stop. He's got to sell books. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it's so funny. He would do things that just I couldn't believe.
Yeah.
You know, the first time I met him was in September. I came down as a – now, remember, I come from Canada. In Canada, they have grades 9, 10, 11, 12, and we had 13 then, which is like the first year of college.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew the words freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. So I came down after Mariucci brought me down to show me the campus, recruit me. I came back, and the first day of class, Mariucci says, go over and get some equipment from the athletic department so you can work out. And so I went over, and Milt was the equipment manager then, and he said to me, can I help you? I said, yeah, I'm Lou Nanny, John Mariucci. Send me over to pick up some equipment. I'm with the hockey team. And he said, Are you a freshman? I thought he said, are you a Frenchman? And I said, no, I'm Italian. And you know, Milt, of course, he was there every day because the university sports were the biggest thing in those days. You know, we didn't have the Twins or Vikings or any of them yet. So the next day he puts it in there and he makes fun of me. And I hadn't met him yet about being an Italian instead of a freshman, you know. So when he came over that day, that's the first time I met him. He said, well, you don't understand what you got here, what you're doing here? And I'll never forget, before I even knew him, he had to make fun of me in the paper.
Yeah.
And he just was like that. He had that devilishness about him. He had the ability to get under some people's skins, and if he did, boy, he'd never let up.
You know the irony about Sid, the a lot of the average rubes don't know, is that, you know, his whole, in print, he was Mr. Positive, right? I mean, Royce and I were the agitators, and he was Mr. Positive. And yet, I know Royce can testify to this, and I certainly can't, during games, there was nobody who could get more negative about what the team was doing, the home team was doing. They're going to lose. They're going to lose. I mean, they could be up 14. You know, no, I don't like the way they're playing. They're going to lose. That guy's awful. That guy's overrated. And it used to crack us both up because you go, well, where is this in print? We never see this in print from you. You're Mr. Negative during the games. And it just shows you he had another side to him. He rarely allowed that to be revealed in what he wrote. But he could be pretty cranky about the home team when he was in the mood for it. I'm sure you ran into that from time to time.
Ran into it. Well, the best case I'll ever tell you about, when I took over as general manager, when we had a first-round pick, we draft him, we take him into the town, and we'd have a dinner the night before, usually at Interlock in the country club. And I invited Sid. Sid always came to the dinner. Mm-hmm. There was me, the coach, my wife, and the draft choice, and Sid. That would be the dinner. So now you got to remember, the first guy I drafted was Bobby Smith. And Bobby was a tremendous player. And he was a tremendous player all the way along. About 4 or 5 years in, and he wasn't happy with the amount of ice time was getting, and maybe he wasn't playing as well as he had been, and so he wanted to be traded. And I said, no, I'm not trading. This went on for 6 months. Well, coming into the season when I did trade him, it was in October, and Bobby was having an off game. Sid came down to where I was sitting in the press box. He says, geez, Bobby's playing like that. You're going to have to trade him. You can't keep him around. You're going to have to move him. I said, no, I don't think so. So I'll tell you, I think you're going to have to trade him. Well, he didn't know that I was going through this at the time with the trade. It wasn't a week later I traded Bobby Smith, and we were playing at home the day that I traded him. Sid comes down to me. He says, how could you trade Bobby Smith? I can't believe you did that. I said, Sid, you told me to do it. That's the only reason why I did it. No, I didn't. I said, yes, you did. I wouldn't want to trade him. There was no way. I said, I lean on you for everything. I thought you were convinced that I had to get rid of him. No, I can't get him back. What am I going to do? He said, don't tell anybody that. I didn't tell you that. And he ran away.
Well, that's classic.
And just like you said, he'd get negative in the press box.
Yeah.
Even when he loved people or teams and nobody else saw it, you would never see it in print.
He'd get frustrated. He because he was wanted the teams to win so badly and to excel. He took it personally, so he would absolutely get frustrated. He would rarely, again, reveal it the next day in the paper, but he would definitely feel it as the game was going on.
And look at how many times, I mean, he'd react like nobody else, in the press box as far as the media goes, and yelling and screaming at the officials or stuff like that. And boy, he did let the officials know, too, in any sport. If he ran into them, he would tell them that they were terrible.
You know, I mentioned earlier the great tape recorder story that I have, which I don't know if you've heard. I've offered it up a couple times over the years. So, you know, and the front page of the Star Tribune Sports section was a brilliant, I thought, cover, blank all the way down to a drawing of the big tape recorder that he's known for. You know, seems to be out of the dark ages, for God's sake. Well, this is when the Vikings were still playing at the Metrodome. And for home games, what would generally happen is we would, go down to the locker room after, talk to people, and he and I, and Patrick, too, would then walk over back to 425 Portland Avenue, where the Star Tribune used to be, and write our columns there. So on this occasion, Sid and I happened to both get done about the same time. So we're leaving Star Tribune, crossing Portland onto the parking lot, at about the same time. He's a little ahead of me, so he doesn't see that I'm out there too. And we both go to our respective cars. And I look back and I see he's opened the trunk of his car and he has placed his briefcase in the car, in the trunk. And then he's moving to, get in the driver's side of the vehicle to drive off, but his trunk lid is still up. So now I'm saying, well, surely he's going to notice that, right? Well, he didn't. He starts backing, out of the parking place, and he's driving. I sprint to try to catch him, and I can't. So he wheels out of the parking lot, hits a bump, car goes up and down, and sure enough, the briefcase, actually it may have just been the tape recorder, comes bounding out of the back of the vehicle. He continues to drive in his merry way. The trunk lid is flapping up and down Portland Avenue, and he doesn't seem to have any clue. So I retrieve said tape recorder. I call somebody at the actually, I waited until I got home, and I just brought it with me because in the back of my mind, I'm going, maybe I'll have some fun with this. So I call. I think I want to say I called Dennis Bracken, who was one of the assistant sports editors then. I said, hey, Bracken, I've got Sid's tape recorder. He didn't even realize he had in the back of his trunk. He didn't even notice that the trunk lid was still up, and he just drove off. And they said, okay, great. I said, I wonder if I should hold on to it. He said, yeah, well, just hold on to it till the morning. I'm kind of curious to see how this goes. I get a phone call the next morning. It might have been from Bracken. Real early, like 7:30. Sid is on the radio pleading with people. Anybody near the Portland Avenue area, downtown Minneapolis, who happens to happen to see a tape recorder on the street, please let me know. That's my tape recorder. So I really wanted to hold him hostage for it for a while longer. I didn't. And we at that point turned it in, and I think he thanked me kinda for about a second, and then he offered up a couple of expletives after that. It was just so classic Sid, the obliviousness all the way through this, including just driving off with it. I don't know how long. He may have driven all the way home to Golden Valley with the trunk lit up, for all I know. It's crazy.
Well, that figures, yeah. It's amazing what that went through. We had so many stories about it. We hit it in the freezer one time after a game in the North Stars. He put it down, and then he started really going nuts because he couldn't find his tape recorder and swearing at everybody. And Doc Rose, you know, pulled it out of the freezer there. And Tommy Reed started yelling at him, was hot news. We have to cool it off. That tape recorder was his signature. That's for sure. I mean, no matter where he went, it went.
He's, it sounds trite to say it, Louie, but we'll never see anybody like him, will we?
No. He just, you know, there's so many stories. I mean, you could sit down and just eat with him and you'd have a story, you know?
Yes. I mean, and half and his sure, food on your on oh your shirt. God. Yeah.
He would. Oh, my God. He used to, you know, the guy was amazing. He came to, he was at my house for dinner one time, and my brother and sister and family in the Sioux have continued a tradition on it. My grandfather and father had, and we make our own salami, and it is the best. You know, you think Genoa is good, but this is the best salami in the world.
Well, that sounds good just thinking
and,
about
and,
it.
And we got about 26 or 28, and he's over at my house, so I decide to give him some salami. And I don't know if you can eat this now. I don't know if this is against the Jewish rules or not, what's in there. And I try to tell him what's in. Oh, no, I can eat it. And he has me. He says, oh, my God. He says, you got to get more of this. I said, I can't. We only get 26, 28. He says, I'll put you in business. I'll back you. Whatever you need, get it. We can sell this. We can do very well with this. I mean, God, he was amazing. You know, and I think of seeing his life, you know, go like for 61 years. And I think that 2 years ago, like this year at his birthday, that day we were supposed to have the big dinner.
That's right.
Bob Hagen and the Vikings put it on. Bob Hagen, I was put it on. And it was 2 years ago, so it was the year before. And he and I and Bud were sitting there after everybody had gone. And I said, how are you doing? And he said, not good. I don't know why I'm living. He says, what do you mean why you're living? You're incredible. Said, you're still working. Next year they'll put you in Sports Illustrated on the cover. 100 years old, still working. Now he says, I can't get around the way I can. I can't hear good. I can't work the way I want. He says, I have no purpose. I said, you got purpose there because everybody every day just lives on your every word. I mean, he was so competitive for him not to be able to do what he wanted to do and had done for so long at such a high level just made him despondent, you know? And that was the first time I really saw him really down like that.
That's interesting. I'd not heard that before. Yeah.
Yeah. It just, because his competitiveness, so I'll tell you, it wasn't that his health was gone or going. And wasn't anything but the fact that he didn't feel he was competing at the level that he always had.
That's what kept him alive, Louis.
He was shortchanging people, and that's what kept him alive. I mean, I could, you know, Chad will tell you, I can tell you, I mean, how many times I talked to him, he talked to him, David talked to him when he was doing 640, 740, and 840 show.
Right.
And when Maxie and I, and he would go on that pie after, and I'd say, you got to quit doing that. Why don't you just have one show? like from 8:40 to 9 o'clock. So you get some rest, and because he'd get up so early, and, you know, he'd be up late. I said, why don't you just do one? No, then they'll get rid of me. I said, nobody's going to get rid of you. I said, well, no, he said, I got to be in the radio. I said, well, you should maybe just write once a week. and you're probably aware, and because I found out, I know, the paper even asked him if he wanted to cut back. He just wouldn't, right to the very end. The guy had there has never been a more driven person in sports, in finance, in industry, anywhere than him. You can't have greater passion and greater drive than this guy had to do his job. It's impossible.
Great stuff, Louie. We appreciate the time as always. We will we'll be back in touch soon. Thank you.
Thanks. You take care.
Outstanding stuff from Lou Nanny. We're, again, a little bit behind schedule, but we'll get caught up. We still have Patrick Roycey, bottom of the 5 o'clock hour, more with Bud Grant. And when we come back, this is going to be a hidden gem because not everybody knows who Bob Hagan, media relations, is. We do. The average Rube might not, but Hagan spent as much time around Sid as pretty much anybody, and I bet you he's got a good nugget or two. He will.
A fan.
You just had a background of everything that went on in the state of Minnesota, particularly on the University of Minnesota, and then as the pro teams came in, you know, the Lakers and the North Stars and the Vikings and the Twins. He had a background of everything, so anything that came up, Sid had some insight as to what was going to happen, and he had the instinct of a reporter that he knew things that were about to happen, so he was in on the ground floor of everything, and he also had a base to which to report what he was doing, and if Sid said it, bank on it. It was true.
Part two of our interview with Bud Grant is now moved to 5:55, so we got time to chat with our next guest and then also get to Roycey at the bottom of the hour. Time for both of these interviews to breathe. Bob Hagan, longtime media relations maven. That's what I call him. I don't know what his fancy title is. Doesn't matter to me. It's just media relations maven for your Minnesota Vikings. And, you know, I'm glad, actually, Garzy played that Bud soundbite because part of what I would think would be fascinating for you and challenging is the number of times you found yourself in a position where you're dealing with both of these legends, Sid, age 100, Bud, age 93, and often, I'm assuming, putting them together or making sure they're okay or getting done whatever they want to get done. What's that been like for you, Bob Hagan?
Well, thanks for having me on, Dan. Being around those two, you know, really has been amazing. I mean, I've probably had 500 lunches minimum with, you know, those two guys together. I've picked up the tab on most of those two. But something that I don't think people give enough credit. A lot of people think, you know, Sid was, you know, Bud's best friend because, you know, that he was the coach, took the team to all the Super Bowls and the playoffs. But, you know, the truth of the matter is they were best friends when Bud was 18 years old and Sid was 25. So it's really been a remarkable relationship over those years. And to spend the time around those two together has really, you know, really been priceless.
We had, you know, Chad on earlier. He was very emotional, not surprisingly, and very insightful, I thought. Like I said, you were around Sid a lot, man, over the decades, a lot, maybe more than ever in some ways. And so what's the last 24 to 40 hours been like for you? I mean, how down are you right now?
Extremely. Yesterday I found out on the sideline in the third quarter, and, you know, I spent the next quarter and a half in tears in the locker room. So I didn't see much of the game. You know, you can insert your own joke here on the game, I guess. But it was very tough. I just went and saw Sid Friday night at his house, you know, and stopped by there after work and spent an hour there hanging out with him, and certainly didn't think it would be the last time I'd see him.
I don't think, again, this is a good example. I know most of your average people that have no reason to know it about how much time, like you said, you spent around Sid. I mean, you got to know him really, really well, worked with him, I know, helped him. And so it's got to be, I mean, that, so you're feeling it also beyond what he was as this, you know, newspaper guy and radio guy. He became very much a friend to you.
Yeah, he was great. He was great to my entire family. I think that's another thing that I really like hearing Chad talk about, how much he always talked about family, always asked about my family, always asked about how my mom was doing, who has Alzheimer's. He came to my kids' graduation parties. He came to their hockey games and tennis matches, and those are two sports he knows absolutely nothing about. So he was very special, you know, to all of us. And, you know, the more you're around him, the more fun you'd have. Every time you'd have a dinner or lunch with him, you'd have four new stories to tell other people. Well, I mean, he was amazing.
Well, let me ask you. So you mentioned the number of lunches you had with Bud and Sid. What would you just listen? Would you moderate? Would you be in the middle of it? How would those lunches, you know, on the average, how would they go?
Yeah, I would play off the history. Most of those lunches, a lot of times, involved the late Fred Zamberletti and Paul Wiggin also. And it was just, you know, I kind of thought it was fun, you know, to be with the old timers and to hear their stories. And Sid's recollection, till the day he died was unbelievable. His memory for things was, I mean, second to none of anybody I've ever met, even in his late years. He was really amazing when it came to that.
Do you remember how you first got to know him, whether there's anything notable about that before you have developed and accrued all this history with him?
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody with Sid gets a nickname at some point. And in 1991, I got an internship with the Vikings in February, and he was coming over, and I was helping him get interviews, and he had no idea my name or anything like that. And somehow I ended up with my friend getting to know Norm Green with the North Stars. And my friend and I would see him before every game. Norm didn't know I worked for the Vikings at this point. And we became a good luck charm during the playoff run. And so he invited us up to the owner's suite when it got to the Stanley Cup semifinal.
Wow.
Conference finals. And when we got up there, Sid was in there. And he was like, how did this kid, who's an intern, make it up to the owner's box? So he gave me the nickname Norm Green Jr. And that was a cool nickname for about 2 years when we went to the Stanley Cup finals. Yes. And we're doing well. And then it was a terrible nickname for the next 14 years. You know, it was the worst name in town you could have.
Oh, I never heard that one. That's a classic. Norm Green Jr. Oh, my goodness.
From years 3 through 14, I was like, do not call me that. This guy took the team out of town. Nobody liked him. It's the worst name possible. And then I finally threatened. I said, you know, no more interviews with Randy Moss or Mike Tyson unless we get rid of that nickname. And it's gone away the last 16 years.
Were you around then when Denny got hired? Because he wanted Pete Carroll, obviously, with his relationship with Pete. Do you remember any of that? Because he got very cranky through that early period at first when you know, Denny got the job and his guy. And I don't think it had anything to do with Denny. It was anything anti-Denny. It was just so much he was pro-Pete.
Yeah, he went after Roger Hedrick at the time pretty good on that one, because he had been told one thing and it was another. And
right.
That was at the end of my internship before I got hired full-time in 1992. So I got to see that side of Sid, but it wasn't, you know, he was mad at him during the press conference, but immediately when the press conference was over, he went right up to Dennis Green and said, I'll be the best friend you have in this town. You know, so he can change very quickly.
That's also true. I've heard you tell the Prince story. Gardsey played some Prince music on the way in, but it is worth retelling once again from the Super Bowl several years ago when Prince had an impromptu meeting with Sid because Sid did not really give him much choice.
Yeah, it was the Super Bowl is down in Miami. Is about 10 years ago. Sid was about 90 years old, and he calls me on the phone, and Prince is going to be doing the halftime show, and he's going to be doing a press conference on Thursday at the convention center, and there's going to be 1,500 media there for the press conference, which turned out to be a press conference slash concert. And so Sid calls me on the phone. He goes, hey, I'm going to come pick up my credential. And I said, well, you can't pick it up at this time because I'm going to be at the Prince press conference. And he said, well, he goes, yeah, I want to talk to Prince. Why don't you have me see Prince? And so I start to argue with him on the phone and tell him he thinks I'm setting up an interview with the Vikings backup linebacker. You know, I'm like, it's not that easy. And he wouldn't take no for an answer. He shows up to there, and I thought I was going to be able to further explain, and I still couldn't get anywhere. And he's like, no, I just want to see him for a little bit. And so I said, all right. And I, you know, did something that I'm like, why am I doing this? But here we go. So we get to checkpoint number one. I just flash a credential, and I just said, follow me. We get to checkpoint number two. I said, don't say a word. Just let me handle this. And the guy just looked at us, and he's like, oh, this guy's 90 years old. What problem is he going to cause? Because my credential would work, but his one.
Right.
So we finally get to the last checkpoint, and the guy says, you can't go any further than this, even with the top credential. And I had to think on my feet, and I just said, sir, with all due respect, the guy about to go on stage and this guy I got right here are the two most famous people in Minnesota. And he let us through, and we walked through, and Prince was walking down this long hall. He's just about to turn to go onto stage, and Sid yells at the top of his lungs, hey, Prince, hey, Prince. And we have about 15 security guys come across the two of us, and Prince stops, turns around very slowly, and parts the sea of all these people and walks all the way back to us. And has a 5-minute conversation with Prince. And it was pretty amazing. It really was.
Do you remember what they talked about? I mean, because I'm wondering if Prince,
they went to the same high school 50 years apart.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, but they started talking. They talked Vikings and they talked Timberwolves because he had been a season ticket holder at both. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talked sports for a little bit and they said, nice to see you. And you know, to this day, Sid just thinks that was easy to set up, and that just
of course
happenstance.
Well, you know, about his insistence to get what he wants, I'm sure that's not the first time, even though that's a very unusual circumstance, that's not the first time you had to go toe-to-toe with him, and I'm sure almost be forced to surrender, right? I mean, that is really... The story of his approach journalistically was he's just irrepressible. I mean, he was one of those guys who was not going to take no for an answer.
No, I think his persistence and drive is what, you know, really separates him, you know, from the rest of the crowd. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, and then we'd spend weeks trying to set up a certain person, you know, for an interview that he'd want. And the second you'd get it, the second he finished that interview, he'd ask for the next biggest person right then. You know, it's like,
yes.
So what have you done for me lately? But he was always on top of things and, you know, just amazing with that.
Did you guys ever do what Louis said occasionally they did in hockey, hide his tape recorder, put it in the freezer or anything to kind of get him going?
Well, there was guys who did that. I mean, when I first started the Vikings, he would travel on the road trips on the plane, coming home from the game.
Sure.
And you know, we'd have those name tags on every seat on the plane so the players and coaches and front office people knew where to sit. And, you know, we would be just going through the regular MSP airport, and as people would walk by, they would slap their name tag on his back. And so he'd be walking through the Minneapolis airport with 50 of these tags on his back. And then he would turn to me and he'd say, God, they love me. They all love me. And we would play a game 7 days later and the same thing would happen over again. And he would never figure it out. And he'd get home and he'd have 50 of these players' name tags on his back.
What are you going to do with yourself, man? Honestly, it's such a obviously a part of who you are. I'm not trying to make you feel bad, but I say it in part because you should feel so good about the relationship and about all those times that you had together. You know, the total investment that you have in him should, to me, be the comfort at a time like this, because you had all of that, and it's going to be sad to not have it, but at least you had it, And you had it in a way that a lot of people can't even begin to appreciate. That's got to be the strength for you right now.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, a lot of times when, you know, maybe a pet peeve of mine when, you know, when people die and they're older, you know, people are like, oh, he's 100 years old, he's a great life. And I say, you know, that is correct. But that means you also knew him longer. So it makes it that much tougher. So, yeah, I just, you know, it's going to be tough. We had that 100 lunch, that yeah. 100th lunch planned at Louie's place. It was a great guest you just had on. And that was going to be on Tuesday, March 17th. And you made the list this year.
I know. I was shocked that you made the list. And I
had 100 people come.
Better yet, I was going to go, which, you know, being the hermit I am, that in itself was amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, I think of all the great times. Yeah. I had tons of people in my office today, you know, telling some of the stories that sometimes I didn't even know. And, you know, just a remarkable person. He's been great to the Vikings. He's been great to the Wilf family when they took over. He's been great to this entire community and this entire region. He will be missed.
I really, Bob Hagan, Media Relations of Minnesota Vikings, I really appreciate the time, your willingness to open up, and you're to be commended for your devotion to him, and far beyond your job, which obviously, because he became a friend to you and became something far more personal as well, and you're to be commended for that. We always appreciate your contributions. You know that very much, and we're thinking of you today, because I know it's hitting you probably as hard as pretty much anybody, for reasons that I think will be apparent to anybody who listened to this interview. Thanks again, Bobby.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Much appreciated. That is Bob Hagan, Minnesota Vikings. We'll get a short segment here, attempt to get caught up again, and then we'll prepare to chat with Patrick Roycey, the official Sid Hartman by
The Fan.
Yeah, we're doing it again. The Fan of Wicks and Jewelers want to give you a shot to put a grand in your hand. It's our national cash contest. Text the keyword FAMILY to 200-200 to enter. Text FAMILY to 200-200.
The series of My Guy stories, my best My Guy Sid story, goes back to one that Steve Ashburner passed along to me. There was it might have been the Wolves' first year. They were playing the Lakers. I don't remember when it was exactly, but I was either ill or I couldn't be at the game, which killed me because it was Magic, and Magic was my guy. Well, so I thought. And, well, no, actually, you know, I'm thinking wrong about this. This was an occasion where I was there and was having a short conversation with him. And Ashburner either was with Sid, or Sid said something to Ashburner like,
well, what's Marino doing talking to Magic?
He goes, well, he kind of knows him from, you know, he covered a lot of NBA stuff back, you know, in his days at Dallas Morning News. And then there was that long pause, and Sid did the old, well, he was Magic's guy. I can't do Sid's voice. Magic's guy before, I was Magic's guy before Barrera was. So these stories are out. They're not made up. They're legendary, and everybody's got one, two, or three, or perhaps four or five of them. I know we're going to have some fun with Roycey on a couple of memories I have that affected both of us that would be Sid-related as well. We are going to run part two of our conversation with Bud Grant at about 5:55 today. We figured we'll get that towards the end part of the program as well. Hagan was great, wasn't he? Bob Hagan, again, a name that is not as well known just because of what he does. He's well known in the media business, obviously. But once again, I mean, this is a guy who literally, same with Bud. I mean, Hagan became sort of their go-to guy when it came to meeting, coming together, setting up lunches, etc.
He is Hall of Fame lunch setter-upper.
One of the greats.
I mean, he's connected. I mean, he was part, I think, of connecting, along with Dark Star, Ron Rosenbaum's dinner.
There's no question.
About, through all of that, like, that's, Bob's unbelievable in that.
He derives great, I think, satisfaction out of bringing people together. And that's a nice asset to have. Let's pause, get caught up, and we will chat with, as I mentioned, Sid Hartman's official and unofficial biographer, Patrick Roycey.
The Fan.
I got
write a postcard.
Well, we sat, you guys sat here 5 weeks ago and said that it's over, period.
Sure,
but here we are. I mean,
you said they're going to come back, right?
Yeah, I did. I never got off the bandwagon one time. And you jumped off so fast,
it made your
head spin.
Your memory
you
is...
You can't even remember where you parked your car. So don't start with me.
We ought to take this goddamn show. We'd find out what you said and what you didn't say.
You've been using that weak routine of yours for about 300 years.
That's a good thing.
This is a joke.
It's a good thing you knew it, because the manager didn't.
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell Gardy?
I was gonna mention it to him.
And the general manager didn't.
Yeah. But this is a few...
And some of the players didn't.
Let me know when you're done.
I'm done.
I think most people know the voices. Dark Star was in there. Maxie, Sid, and our next guest, Patrick Royce, kind enough to join us. As well, I assume it is true, sir, that the stuff that was left on the during the commercials or on the cutting room floor from the sports show would probably be even more riveting than the actual TV show itself. Correct?
They between breaks when Dark and Sid let their entire animosity for one another leak out. It was always intriguing. They had the advantage of doing a show together when they really couldn't stand each other, you know. There was about 6 days a year when Dark and Sid got along, and the rest of the time, you know, because Dark would not bow to Sid's,
right.
Omnipotent status in the Twin Cities, and that drove Sid nuts.
So, which meant,
and you know what was the kicker?
What's that?
When Darky showed up at the front table with Knobloch when he signed.
That's right.
Remember when Knobloch invited him up there for the sign? That was the end for Sid.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's a classic. You and I think had kind of the same reaction to the news yesterday. You mentioned, you know, that it's a testament to Sid that the man's 100 years old and you're still shocked that there's an announcement that he's passed away. I came at it similarly, just said the old World According to Garp book by Irving, in which he says we're all terminal cases, and that Sid was the one guy that had me questioning the premise. I mean, that's the, I guess, the irony of this thing, or maybe the proof of how dominant he was, is we were still surprised that it happened.
Yeah, and after you left us about full time radio, and I kind of did some of that myself. He became even more insecure. He would not take a day off. He would not take a week off anymore. I mean, it was amazing how much he needed it, and how much he needed to be in that paper 3-4 days a week. And it's kind of a interesting psychological mystery that I would never be able to solve.
No.
His need for it was unbelievable. And, that he was still going. I did have one last chance to tell him. And I did to talk to him during the pandemic, and I said, Sid, the pandemic has made you even more of a homer. Unbelievable. He never wrote a pandemic column that wasn't a complete kiss up to some demon town. He was Sid to the utter finish, I'll say that.
Do you remember back in the day where early Sunday columns were a thing, and if we weren't writing on deadline, there was hope that we would submit them Friday night in order to get the outstate edition out? And so the bit would be that Sid would come in Saturday, what, noonish, and the first thing he would have done, he would order is that somebody, some minion would have to print your column if it was already in, and or my column if it was already in, so that he knew exactly what we'd written, and he could either rebut it in his own Sunday column, or if it was a feature column, write like 9 paragraphs about that individual as well. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. It was unbelievable. I did love the ones where he cut you off at the pass.
Yes.
That's the one you bring. You know, and I used to always tell him, don't give that bleeping bleeper a copy of the column when he came in. Whoever was in there, I said, don't let him see it. Oh, that's okay. Get it in. Yeah, he was unbelievable.
Well, how about McEnroe and Eisen when they were doing investigative stuff?
Oh, yeah.
They had to hide in another part of the building, that secret cubbyhole of theirs, because they knew if it was a gopher-related deal, if Sid found out about it, the cat was going to be out of the bag. So they had to suppress it from him, from a teammate who works for the same newspaper.
Yeah, I've tried to figure out that aspect of him. I actually talked to him when I wrote a thing about him on his 100th birthday, which was smaller than a kiss up than this was today. But I talked to Tim McGuire about it. And I said, what was it? What caused him to be, you know, the ultimate homer? And he thought it was acceptance. He was a 10-year-old kid from, you know, North Minneapolis with no money, selling newspapers on the street corner, and he wanted people to feel, you know, to like to run into him. And now he didn't care about you and I and the negative geniuses. By the way, I was saying earlier today, he's the only guy who used geniuses as a negative, by the way. If you were called a genius, you might as well be called a, you know, whatever profanity you can think of. But it's amazing how he was still. I call him an insecure egomaniac. It was kind of a contrast. I mean, he managed to remain insecure even as he became a one-word celebrity in his entire state and lauded everywhere he went. But it was it's amazing how he just, you know, as you know, the what's everybody's going to say about Sid 10 years ago is he had a column in the paper the day he died. That's
exactly right. By the way, McGuire's theory was the same as Chad's. He told us an hour ago about that, the 9-year-old, and about, he even talked about, you know, he's his father drank a lot, was an alcoholic. He was not really very helpful. He was very close to his mom, as I'm sure you know, but he said the same thing. It was that 9-year-old kid doesn't finish high school the whole bit, and that a lot of that insecurity was bred there no matter what came after, and that became the thing he fed off of, or couldn't rise above. That sort of made him the way he was. So McGuire might have been onto something.
Well, the psychology. I want to give you a little psychology about his insecurity. I write his book, right?
Yes.
1996. I write his book, and he's the only sports writer that needed somebody to write his book. But you know, that's another story.
Yes.
But so, like, 3 days after it's published, and he comes over to me and says, because he's getting, people are reading the thing and they're saying, well, why didn't you write about this? Why didn't you write about this? He says, we got to write another book. You know, I, honest to God, it wasn't even the first of the year yet. It was like a month. I said, Sid, we got a contract. We can't write another book. I said, I'm going to write a book when you're no longer with us. I'm going to call it The Truth.
Refresh my memory about how you became Sid's official biographer.
You know, he paid me to do it. He paid me to write it.
And did you have any trepidation? Because you got to spend a lot of time with him. And my thought on Sid was he was probably a gold mine of stories, but he didn't always know what he had. And so what was that process like? Was it fun? Was it painful? Okay. Was it aggravating?
Here's what happened. I started off trying to interview him. Well, and to try to interview him chronologically, and discovered that they had no chance of working because he would be 40 years ahead and back and all over. So basically what I ended up doing then is coming up with, well, 50 categories with sub-clauses and questions on them, and said, okay, get yourself a tape recorder, answer all these questions, and then I got a transcript of that, and then I went back and re-interviewed him. And dollars per hour, it was not one of my great things ever. But here's the highlight was when I'd give him like two chapters at a time, and one day One day I give him the chapter that has his date of birth on there, and he scratches it out. It's scratched out when he gives it back to me. And I said, Sid, we got to have your date of birth in there. We're going to be charging people $25 or something. And he says, they don't need to know when I was born. Just say I was born. Okay. I said, okay, Sid. You know, some of us thought you were chaps, hatched. So that's okay, but unbelievable.
Let me ask you about, you know, I can remember when I was still relatively new. I think it was when the Vikings made that playoff run in 87. And so, based on what I had already picked up, so I'd been there about a year at this point, and what I'd picked up was that, you know, at least publicly, Sid and you and Sid and Souchere were at major odds, you know, major oh, yeah. odds. So I'm thinking there's almost like this open hatred. And then it turns out the day where it's that we're about to go to this is RFK Stadium. That's how far back it goes. And we all happen to have, it turns out, hotel rooms on the same floor in Washington. I don't know where we were staying. And I hear a commotion out in the hallway, and it's Sid and it's Souchere, and they're talking like they're good buddies and they're friendly. And I was all confused. I said, wait a minute. I thought Sushi Boy couldn't stand Sid. So can you explain the psychology of, on the one hand, because we all had kind of had it with Sid, hating him at times, being frustrated with him at times, and yet then still having these human moments with him.
Well, Such had a better reason to be bitter because Sidney basically got his column as a start as a Tribune sports columnist pulled.
Right.
You know, because of the whole Metrodome mess. But I guess Such must have just said, you know, they had some, when Such was this neophyte and he'd travel around with Sid and, you know, they'd sit and keep the door open to the other hotel room so in case he was had a crisis or something, and Such would tell stories about having to go off and go across the hall and turn the shower off because he didn't know how to turn the shower off and stuff like that. And I think Such has a powerful bride, and she might have said, just forget it and get along with it, but I don't know what it is. But listen, I was thinking about this today, Dan. If there's anybody who should be grateful for Sid, it's you.
How so?
Because you ended up in this market because of Sid, because no matter what Bozich tells you, sitting next to Sid for a half of a Gopher game is the reason he called up his boss and said, I want to come home.
Yeah,
drove Bozich out.
That's a great point.
Got you. Yes,
I hadn't thought of it that way. You're right. I mean, in fact, I got the call from Bozich myself. I was sitting in my apartment, in my condo in Dallas. It's a Saturday night. It's that night of that game. He went to his Sid, and he basically said, I can't stay. I'm going to show up at Arnie Robbins' door, his house. And he did Sunday morning and said, I can't do it. You're right. And if he hadn't, who knows? I'd probably still be molding in Dallas.
I was there, and he left at halftime. He was supposed to do like a 15 inside bar or something. He just after a half of hearing Sid cheering and screaming and complaining about the officials, he just left.
Do you have a theory on why he and Bud seem to hit it off beyond just the professional part of it? I mean, you wrote a lot about that. You know that. What's that all about?
Well, you know, 1949, Bud's on campus. Sid lets him use his car. Sid lets him do all this other stuff. Bud's been known to take advantage of situations, but somehow it developed into a, you know, I think Bud's wife, Pat, liked Sid a lot, and he'd always bring gifts and stuff like that. And but to have the world's greatest outdoorsman be a good buddy of a guy who couldn't tell a goose from a squirrel is a phenomenal.
Astonishing.
Because there couldn't have been two guys more different in the entire world, and I don't understand it. There was certainly part of it was, I think initially it was Bud probably taking advantage of Sid trying to, you know, get information and whatever, be a buddy with that You know, there's a famous 1949 Gopher football team that Bud was on that was supposed to go to the Rose Bowl, and Sid was the beat guy, and, you know, and that's where the friendship started. But then, you know, Sid signed him for the Lakers, or helped sign him for the Lakers, and I don't know. You know, as mysterious as Sid is, there's a little mystery about Bud, too, so I don't think I can analyze it, but it's phenomenal to me that these two opposite human. I mean, one guy is the most common sense, think everything out guy in the history of the mankind, and the other never had more than 2 straight hours of sleep in his life without popping up in bed and having some weird thoughts in his head. You know, I mean, complete opposite, but somehow it worked. I don't know how that worked.
It's the astonishing part about it. Just a couple last things before we go. We're chatting with Patrick Royce on Sid. Do you buy the notion? There are homers in other towns, okay, but do you buy the notion that he set a template that was so overpowering that it did indeed make it harder for guys like you and me who kind of want to push back and want to needle and want to occasionally even rip rather vociferously, that it really made it harder than it otherwise would have been in other places? Do you think that it was that different, this market, because of him?
I do think... In my immaturity of younger age, it made me more determined to push back. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, there were, I got to admit, I didn't write 3 straight columns when Indiana came to town praising the great program without mentioning Bobby Knight's name because of Bobby Knight, because I wanted to agitate them. So, you know, I think that in my younger years, that I did, you know, that I push back harder. I think it certainly created a situation in town where you had especially with Gopher fans, you had this huge population that didn't want to hear the truth. And that was probably, it might have been a little more difficult where, you know, it's to take a shot, you know. And here's the other thing. Nothing that was this. Sidney never wrote a subtle sentence in his life, right? So any attempts at subtle, you know, sarcasm, you know, stuff like that, fell flat with the Sid audience. So there's something to that. But I think in the end, it led to more negative reporting than more positive reporting.
Probably right.
You didn't want to be like Sid.
Right.
You didn't want to be put in that category.
Last item, who first called him? Was it you or somebody? How did he get the moniker, the great man?
I think I started calling him that in print, but I don't know if it came from...
Okay.
I think I did probably call him that in print because, you know, at least in the opinion of... In the opinion of a lot of people, including him, he was a great man. What I always loved best about him, I would have liked to seen Sid's eulogy to himself. That's what I would have liked to seen. Because every other eulogy he wrote ended up being a tribute to himself.
That was our joke, yes.
Somehow he would twist them around to what he did for that person. And it would be nice to see. That would never work, but it would be a nice satirical column to write. Sid Bain tribute to Sid would be pretty good, but I don't think we have an appetite for
that. No, you're probably right about that. Well, you're right. A lot of times it would even be the salute to himself for being the one guy who could get him on the phone, you know, the guy who died on the phone, so as opposed to any sort of, what do you remember about the guy himself? It was became kind of an open joke for us. The work was exemplary, man, today. You guys did a really, really, did yourself. And I know the obit, you said a lot of it had been already written, but I know you added some stuff to it and you wrote some other stuff. And even the video stuff that you guys have is smart, man, because it's almost time capsule, kinds of things. So, you guys did a really good job. You started for sure.
We had, Thank you a lot. We had one big screw-up, though. The tape recorder that they drew a picture of was the second version. We did the old one that you could have beat off buggers with.
Oh, no.
Remember that one? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a more modern tape recorder. They should have had the picture to draw.
They should have, yeah. I guess I didn't even, you know, Charles Hallman had tweeted me and mentioned something about that, and I didn't understand it, but I guess that's what it was. I didn't look at the drawing closely enough.
Because, I mean, the old one, Gaetti and Herbeck and those guys used to get on it and leave these propane messages and stuff.
Yeah.
He'd leave it around and he'd be playing it and it'd say, hey, Sid, bleep, 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 and all this stuff. So,
end of an era. Unbelievable.
You know, we can say about everybody, we'll never see his like again. But in this case, 100% accurate.
Thank you. I appreciate it as always, man. Be good.
All right.
Thanks, Patrick. That's Patrick Roycey. A name that probably at this point should need no introduction. Speaking of names that don't need introduction, part two with Bud Grant. No time to waste. Part two of our conversation with Bud Grant about his, 75-year friendship with Sid. And I think we pick it up with more University of Minnesota time and connections between the two of them. As much as he became very much a supporter of the pro teams, as you know, starting, I think, certainly, well, eventually with the Vikings, most of all, once the Lakers left, in my time with him, I always sensed that there was something special about his feelings regarding the University of Minnesota. That was, even above the Vikings, above all of them, that was on its own plateau. Do you agree?
I don't disagree at all. And he... for not having ever attended a college or the university, I think he got up because when he worked for the newspapers, he was what they call a stringer. I mean, he would go to the games or he'd go to practices and he'd provide information for some of the other writers or current events. If something happened, if somebody got hurt or something happened in that area, Sid was there. He knew it. And that was his grounding, I think, was the University of Minnesota. It was a love that he carried his whole life. And if anything, he had one wish, it was the university would do well. And in any sport, I mean, he knew the Mariucci's, he knew the Gills, and he knew all the great players at the University of Minnesota on a close personal basis. He made it a point to ingratiate himself to everybody that played at the University of Minnesota. I don't know anybody that had anything to do with the university that had anything bad, but they say about Sid Hartman in his reporting, is how they were treated by him in his columns, and the fact that he may have knew a lot of stuff that he didn't put on the radio or put in the newspaper, simply because it wasn't appropriate, and they appreciated that, and they trusted Sid implicitly.
You spent, as you said, so much time with him. What did you guys talk about?
You know, surprisingly, we talked a lot about family, and that's where you get close to people. He knew my wife and my kids, and he grew up with them, and he would, when I was in Winnipeg, for example, as a player, and then later, he'd come to Winnipeg just overnight, just to see us, to see the family, to go to a game, to keep up to date. At one time, Sid did not have much of a family. Finally, Chad came into his life, which was a great thing for Sid and his other family relationship. But he's very, very close to my family. My kids think the world of Sid. He's like a grandfather to all of them. And I don't know. I think at a younger, impressionable age like we were, that it's an imprint that stays there. And he's been very close to this family for many, many years.
You've talked a little bit about when you first met him. What were your initial impressions of him? Anything stand out from those days?
Well, the first, when I was during the war, I was in the Navy at that time, and the other, I played on the basketball team at Great Lakes, and we came to Minnesota to play a basketball game. And this guy came up to me and said, first thing he said, he introduced, I don't know if he introduced himself even, but he said, where are you going to go to college? He was way ahead of us. I said, who is this guy? Well, he introduced himself. Well, I'm Sid Hartman, which meant nothing to me at that time. But that was his first, it's an inclination as to what his, you know, he wanted a scoop. Where was I going to go to college? At that time, I was considering Notre Dame and Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota. And that's when I met Sid. The second time I saw him, I walked up. I enrolled at the University of Minnesota after the service, and I walked in the Cook Hall my first day at the campus, and I walked in the door, and there was Sid Hartman standing there, or walking in with me, actually, introduced himself, and I did remember him because of his brash nature when we met at the basketball game. I remembered him. We walked in. That was his first day as a beat reporter. There's a difference between a stringer and a beat. And he had a beat now. The Minnesota University of Minnesota was his beat. He was working for the Times at that time, and he was a beat reporter. And we walked in together, and our careers went from that point up to date. And we've been, you know, close personal friends. And that doesn't even express how close it is. It's not just that you're a friend, but you're a confidant, your emotions, your families, and your decisions, and all of the decisions that Sid made or I made, we shared with one another before we actually made them in most cases.
Equity there, right? I mean, that's built up over, in the case of you two, decades. That's what keeps that thing and nurtures it and makes it powerful, correct?
Well, that's right. Now, Sid is as I've mentioned or will mention again, that there's nobody in my life that I've had closer or longer than Sid Hartman. Now, he was 100 years old. I'm 93. I've known Sid longer than I've known my parents or my kids or anybody I've ever worked with or my wife. Sid and I have been friends longer than anybody I've ever had in my lifetime.
Will you tell the story about Bud when you wanted to give him the scoop that you were going to retire, and the plan was you guys were going to go over to Hawaii to do that, where I'm presuming the owners were, and what took place that prevented him from traveling with you all the way on that final leg to Hawaii?
Well, you got to understand that Sid wants to know things first. He's not as interested in being second or third. He wants to know things first. And it doesn't have to be major, but, he's always anticipating, you know, what your future plans are. And we talked a lot about that. And I also said, you know, if ever you're going to change jobs or you get fired or you're going to move, you know, let me know first. He didn't actually say it that way, but he expected that he would be privy to anything that I might do in my life first. Well, I decided that I was going to retire from coaching, so I asked Sid to travel with me to Los Angeles. He said, why? I said, well, I got a scoop for you. Well, that's good enough for Sid. So we got an airplane. On the airplane, I said, no, I want you to come to Hawaii with me because I'm going to tell Max Winter that I'm retiring and I want, you know, you to be there when this happens. He's a good friend of Max's, and there might be some story involved. Well, I've come to find out, which I did not know at the time, that Sid did not like, he had a phobia, if that's the right word, to travel over water. Now, don't ask me to explain that. He said, I will not fly over water. I will not go to Hawaii with you. What's the story? So I had to tell him the story in Los Angeles. I'm stepping down, but he couldn't use it until I had the chance to tell Max Winter and Mike Lynn, who were in Hawaii at the time. So that's really what happened. And so Sid held the story until I could inform Max and Mike that I was stepping down, and then he could use he had the scoop, which in your people's lingo is kind of important.
That's everything, and for him it was absolutely everything, 100%.
Absolutely.
Did you ever get mad at him?
Well, we disagreed on a number of things, not of a major nature, but we talked about a lot of things, and he was a confidant. And like he said himself, he said he never made a major decision until he talked to me about it. Not that he talked to me, not that he wanted advice, but he'd run it by me, or I'd run it by him. And not necessarily major things, but, you know, family things and you know, working relationships and decisions on what where do I buy a new car, or how do I get a new refrigerator or something, things like that. We talked about a lot of not necessarily earth-shattering things, but we shared a lot of our feelings, you know, just because we're friends.
You know, as we wrap up here, Bud, it occurs to me, you know this better than I, that we're talking about someone who is a one of a kind. I mean, there's never going to be another guy. The conditions aren't going to be the same. He is utterly unique. He is historic in Minnesota sports. And I'm talking to another historic voice from Minnesota sports as well, which is, I'm trying to wrap my head around that. That's pretty tough to do. But you guys both, I think, represent so much on the basis of what you came from, what made you what you are, and you're both kind of in that same category.
Well, I've used this analogy, you know, in your lifetime you're lucky if you've got two or three good friends. Now, in a lifetime you will go through many friends and many acquaintances and many business people. And in the sporting world, many, you know, personalities that you run into. But you're lucky if you got a couple that are close. And I've been very fortunate, and I think Sid might have expressed the same thing, that we were close personal friends. I mean, we could trust one another with what we want, what our thoughts were, what our emotions were, and what we're thinking, what our future looked like. And, you know, it's a great asset to have a friend like Sid Hartman. And if you use the word Sid in this Midwest, there's only one Sid.
We'll leave it.
And everybody knows who you're talking about if you just mention Sid. Sid Hartman was that person.
Bud, always a pleasure. I really appreciate the time as always, and stay well. And
as well as I can,
well,
you bet.
As well as you can. That's all we can ask. Thanks again for the time, Bud. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Bud Grant, 93, talking about his friend, Sid Hartman, 100 years old. One last chance to put a grand in your hand, Garzy.
Thanks to Wixon Jewelers. Text HAPPY to 200-200. That's your keyword. Text HAPPY to 200-200.
Show wrap and a couple final thoughts on a very unusual edition of